Now we have the best part of the evening, the comments, the questions, and the complaints. So who's got the first question? Okay, this is another story which I tell very often to get a question from you. And this is also quoting from the Buddhist scriptures, the Chula Kama Vibhanga Sutra of the Majjhima Nikaya, where one day a man came and saw the Buddha and wanted to ask questions about karma and reincarnation or rebirth. And he started off by saying, why is it that some people are born wealthy? Well, if they're not born wealthy, they work not really hard and make all this money, they're rich. Why other people, you work so hard and you still can't manage to pay off your mortgage? Why are some people destined to be poor while other people are rich? What's the karmic cause for wealth and poverty? And the Buddha sort of gave that answer. And he continued, why is it that some people are born beautiful while other people are born ugly and remain ugly? And you notice when I mention the word ugly, I was looking at the table. And the reason is that once I gave this simile in Singapore, and I just happened to be looking at one woman when I mentioned the word ugly, and she complained bitterly, why did you mention the word ugly when you were looking at me? I said, bro. So the Buddha gave that answer. But most importantly, the man asked, why is it that some people are so intelligent? At school they do well, at university they just breeze through university and they're so clever. While other people, doesn't matter how much you study, you still remain stupid. He said, what is the karmic cause of stupidity in your next life? And the Buddha replied, you can check this out for yourself. The karmic cause for stupidity in your next life is not asking questions in this life. Any questions? We got a question from the young man over there. How do we find out Buddhism? By coming to the temple. I found out Buddhism by reading a book. I told this at my school at Latimer. I started to do well when I was only 16. It was actually at 16 I called myself a Buddhist, not 17. And it was in mathematics, my first school prize. And my teacher said, go to Foyles in Charing Cross Road and buy a book on maths. So I went there and saw all these incredibly boring books on mathematics. And I thought, those are the books you can get from the school library. I'm not going to waste my first school prize on that. Instead, I always knew that religion was important in life. But I didn't know which religion to choose. So I went to the opposite side of the road, the annex, the top story, where had all the books on different religions. And I bought a copy of the Quran. I bought a book on Buddhism, on Judaism. I think I already knew much about Christianity. And I read them all. I did what we now call market research. And doing market research, you compared all the different religions. And the model I liked, you know, was Buddhism. It was economical. You didn't have to pay a tithe every week you went to church. In a Christian church, you have to pay 10% of your salary before tax. In Islam, every year, it's one of the five pillars of Islam, you've got to give a huge amount of charity. So I really prefer Buddhism. It's really good Buddhism. You know, one of the other reasons I prefer Buddhism, when I read it, because I always knew in Christianity they had this saying in the Bible. Actually, I told this story at the Chinese Chamber of Commerce in Australia 2 months ago. Because somebody actually asked me this in question time. They said, in the Bible it says, it's harder for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. That's in there. You probably heard that before. Harder for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than a rich person to enter the kingdom of heaven. And I know there's a lot of debate and argument about actually what it means, a camel through an eye of a needle. whatever it means it's really, really hard for any rich person to get into the kingdom of heaven. So they ask me, what do you think about that, Ajahn Brahm? And I say, we don't have that saying in Buddhism. So if you're a rich person and want to go to heaven, you better become a Buddhist quick. And in a Chinese Chamber of Commerce, I said, that's my marketing campaign to make sure all you rich people convert to being a Buddhist quick. Otherwise, you'll never get to heaven as a Christian. That was only being funny. But certainly there was something about Buddhism when I started reading it which was very, very attractive. And it was attractive because you could question it. It was according to science. It was a realized religion, which I said in the Thai temple, which means that you had to realize it for yourself. You weren't told what to believe. You were helped to find out. The sacred texts were actually your meditation, your heart told you what to understand. Not the books. The books were the menus. They weren't the food. And when you tried it out, it gave you a lot of peace, not when you die, but right now. And because of that, as soon as I started reading those books, that's where I became a Buddhist. So you really become a Buddhist just by testing it out. That's where you come across the Buddha. Yeah, in the back. The four things which make it difficult to make choices, really, it's not really difficult, it's like a checklist. So, you know, whatever choice you're making, is it just for me? Or is it personal desire? And if it's personal desire, you shouldn't sort of follow that. If it's, instead of for me, if it's for us, then it's not out of personal desire. The benefit of the family, the benefit of the community, the benefit for everybody. That's how you make desires, not what's in it for me, what's in it for us. So that's number one. And sometimes people make choices out of ill will, out of anger. So you know, even when you are talking to somebody and you want to sort of try and help them, you should never help them with anger and say, you stupid girl, why do you ask that stupid question? That's out of anger. So you have to respect people and have no anger in your heart whenever you speak to somebody. And again, the delusion is one of the big ones. Gain as much information as you possibly can. You know, if, say, it is an abortion you're contemplating, know exactly what's happening inside the womb. What would happen if you have an abortion? What would happen if you don't? Is there other people who could maybe adopt that child or look after it? If the child is somehow deformed, now how much deformed are they? Is there some way that you can maybe look after that child with some help or with some other people caring for that child? Now what does actually that deformity really mean? Do the research, do the investigation. Talk it over with your friends, with your parents, so you get as much information and help as possible. That's what I mean by not acting out of delusion. So the fear thing is something we should never act out of. And too many people are dominated by fear. They won't do a decision because they're afraid of what other people might say about them. They're afraid of breaking a precept or doing a sin. And fear just dominates so many people. Sometimes in some religions there's a fear of going to hell. If you don't sort of give a donation to the London Buddhist Vihara. You know, the last person who came to a talk and didn't put a donation in the box? They just went outside and they were just knocked over by a car. Their house was burgled. And people who say things like that, they're acting out of fear. And we don't do that in Buddhism. So don't make decisions out of fear. And then you actually can make good decisions. Does that make sense? So what's that? Can you shout? Because I can't hear you properly. That's right, it's no good or bad decision, just make it happen. So make that decision, check all those lists, and then you've got a good chance of what you do will work out fine. Yeah? Form of meditation is very easy. Meditation is learning how to make your mind still. Imagine your mind like a lake. It's a very primal symbol for the mind, a lake. And all of the thoughts, agitations, emotions are like waves on the surface of that lake. When you have waves on the surface of the lake can never reflect the full moon and the stars above it perfectly. Everything becomes distorted. The only way you can get a pure reflection of the sky and maybe the forest around that lake is when that lake is perfectly smooth, without a ripple on its surface. When it's so glassy smooth, you have a clear reflection of everything in the waters of those lakes. The reflection of life is called insight. The stillness of the lake, the mind, is achieved through meditation. So when meditation is learning how to generate the stillness of a mind, then you have the right concept of what meditation is. So once you know what the goal of meditation is, stillness, then the next thing to understand is how do you bring the mind to stillness? And I usually give this simile. I need the help of those in the front row here. I'm now going to hold this glass of water still. Is it still yet? I'll try harder. Is it still yet? I'll really try. Come on, put more effort into this, Ajahn Brahm. Is it still yet? That's the wrong way to meditate, trying to hold your mind still. You'll never get the mind still with effort. So how is this glass of water brought to stillness? Yeah, easy. I just put it down and wait patiently. And now that water is more still than I could ever hold it. Is that correct? Is it still there? That's how we meditate. To put the mind down. However, what many people do, they put the mind down for a few minutes. Is it still yet? That is not how to meditate. Because people are just so impatient. So we put the mind down and leave it alone. And we wait. And as we wait, we can watch the mind get more and more still. Because it's the nature of the mind to be still. We interfere with it. So that's how we learn how to be content. Not change life or control it, but put it down for a while. The rest of your life you have to sort of hold things and do things and work and look after your family, look after your life, of your whatever you're doing in life. It's a lot of hard work. But we come to the times when we meditate, we put down all of our burdens, we let them go. And we become still. One of the methods which I also encourage people to do is when you first close your eyes and you sit down on a chair or on a cushion, you get your body reasonably comfortable and you can do the following mental exercise. You can imagine yourself holding two heavy shopping bags. You've just been to Sainsbury's and you've got your weekend shopping. One heavy bag in the left hand, one heavy bag in the right hand, and it's really aching on your arms. You imagine that bag in your left arm, and it's not shopping. The bag in the left hand represents all of your past, which we carry around with us day after day, sometimes dreaming about it at night, and it aches, it hurts. And the bag in your right hand, also so heavy, symbolizes your future with all of your plans, your hopes, your concerns and worries in the bag in your right hand. In this mental exercise you feel the weight of your past and your future which you carry around. Now you focus on the bag in your left hand and you imagine yourself lowering it to the ground. And as soon as the bag reaches the ground, all the weight, the burden disappears. Can you imagine moving your hand away from that bag so your left arm is hanging loosely by your side, resting? And then you imagine your right arm holding another heavy bag of your future. And you imagine lowering that down to the ground until the weight disappears, moving your hand away from that handle until your right arm is loosely by your side. You look down upon those bags, your past and your future. You've let them go. You're free. You'll have to pick them up again later. In the time of meditation, you put them down. It's a mental exercise which has a psychological power of helping you to let go of the real past and the real future. Put them down for a while so you can be free from all that you're worried and concerned about. So those are how we meditate. So it's a very simple method you could do at any time. Imagining two heavy bags, past, future, lowering them to the ground and feeling free from the past and free from your future. And then you're very peaceful. That makes sense? Okay. Anyone else want to be intelligent in your next life? Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's another question I should have mentioned. So thank you for bringing up people in comas on life support. Again, just like the dog or the cat, if that's your mother or father or your brother on life support, and the doctor comes to you as the nearest of kin and says, can I switch the machine off now? They've gone. There's no possibility of survival. You ask your mother, in a coma, are you still there? And you will know, it's your mother, that they're still there. I developed this method after hearing of one of my friends over in Singapore who was in a coma. She obviously came out, she told what it was like and what happened. She said she was in, this is how she described it in her words, in a very, very dark place for, she didn't know how long. And she said it was the sound of a temple bell jingling, which brought her out from that very dark place, back into her body. And I know as a meditator, it's sound which takes you out of the deepest of meditations. The last sense which disappears in deep meditation is the sense of hearing. And the first which comes back again is the sense of hearing. It is why we wake up in the morning to the sound of an alarm clock. Not to someone shaking us. Sound actually penetrates the mind more than anything else. So sound brought her out of her coma. But she was in her body, not able to speak, not able to move anything in her body, but completely percipient of the conversation which was going on around her. Her sons were there around her, and the doctor was telling the sons, there's no possibility of recovery. Your mother's in a coma and basically she's dead. Can I switch off the ventilator? And being a Chinese family, the younger sibling said, it's the elder son's decision. And he said, no way, I need help. He said, no, it's your decision. So the eldest son was deciding whether to turn off the ventilator or not, with the mother listening to every word of the conversation. And she said, at that time, she was willing with every part of her mind, son, I'm still here, don't turn it off. But she couldn't say those words, she just willed it. And she said it was just one of these moments where her life and death were being considered. And because she could tell the tale, obviously the son said, don't turn it off yet, give her another 24 hours. That's all it took in those 24 hours for her to start moving some of her body. And the doctor to realize that she was still there. But she eventually made a full recovery. And you see her today, you wouldn't realize just how close she came to death. And from experiences like that, I know that sometimes the doctors don't know whether they're still there or not. But if that's You're the next of kin. That's your mother or your father. You will know. So ask that question. I've done that many, many times. Had amazing results. One of the disciples over in Thailand would go over to Bangkok and see the mother who was in a coma. And every time the daughter went, I know she's still there. And I went to visit her. She's still there. She's still there. But the last time I went to visit her, I said, she wants to go. Even I wasn't the related, but you could feel very clearly she's about to go. She wants to go. She's tired. She had the mad cow disease. I forget the proper name of it. Her brain was infected and just basically deteriorated. And she'd been fighting it for about 4 years. And she had enough. And I told the daughter that. And actually that they didn't need to turn off the ventilator because the mother had actually died the next day. It was a wonderful time because I was only in Bangkok for 3 days. The first day I went there, I told her she's going. Second day she died. Third day I did the funeral service for her. Very efficient. And another case was a Vietnamese gentleman who was in the ICU in our hospital in Perth. I was visiting about 3 times a day. And again, sitting, he was in a coma, but you'd know that he was still there, he was fighting. And there was a time he was almost giving up, and then he was fighting again and giving up again. As you'd imagine would be the case if you're fighting these terrible diseases. And in the end I went there one day, and it was different. He'd gone. His stream of consciousness had left his body. And it wasn't that hard to perceive that, to know that. You don't have to have any psychic powers. It's not psychic power stuff, it's just sensitivity. And I told the doctors, he's gone. And they were quite impressed. How do you know that? And so the next day they turned off the machine. So you can do that. It's very easy. Just ask the question, feel that's your mother, that's your father, and you know that there's no consciousness left in there. And if then you turn off the machine, you're not killing anybody. They're already gone. The stream of consciousness has left the body. They're not a person anymore, they're just a machine being kept going by another machine. That's not killing. So we're very precise with our understanding of the nature of the mind and body in Buddhism. Because we meditate, we know what happens. Does that make sense to you? Okay. Yes. Okay, you're trying to be a good person, you're trying to do good things in life, there's a part of yourself which is always dragging you down. What do you do with that? And of course, what you do with that is you embrace and accept that negative part of yourself. The classic story, which I've used many, many times, it's a beautiful simile which you can employ in your situation and many other situations, is the story of the demon in the emperor's palace. This actually comes from the Udana, one of the books in the Buddhist Tripitaka, but I have adapted it quite considerably. And this story goes like this, that once there was a palace in the kingdom with an emperor, but one day the emperor was away on some business, and while he was away, this monster came into his palace. This monster was just so ugly and frightening that all of the soldiers who should have been guarding the palace froze in fear, allowing the monster to go right into the throne room and sit on the emperor's chair. And as soon as the monster sat on the emperor's chair, the ministers told the guards, "Get that guy out of here!" And the guards, the soldiers, threatened with their swords, said, "You don't get out of here soon, you'll be in trouble." And they threatened and got angry and abused. And every act of unkindness, every angry word, every unkind thought, that demon grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, and more offensive in his language. That just made them more upset. And every unkind word, unkind deed, unkind thought, Another inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, more offensive became the monster. And it had been going on for a long time when the emperor came back. And by this time, that demon was so huge, it was taking up half the throne room, and was so frightening, was so ugly, that even Hollywood would not be able to manufacture anything so scary. And as for the stench coming off this terrible monster, as I wrote in my book, the smell was enough to make a maggot throw up and be sick. And the language was worse than you'd hear, you know, in the streets of London after England lost a soccer match and got kicked out of the World Cup. It was terrible language. But the emperor knew what to do. That's why he was emperor. When he saw this terrible, ugly, smelly, offensive demon, he said, "Welcome. Thank you for coming to visit me. Why have you waited so long to drop in?" And those few kind words, the demon grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less smelly, less offensive. And everybody knew what the mistake was and how to proceed. Instead of trying to kick the demon out, they welcomed it. Someone said, "Have you had anything to drink yet? Would you like a cup of tea? We've got green tea, we've got Sri Lankan tea, we've got peppermint, it's good for your health." Someone said, "You want something to eat? We've got a fish and chip shop just round the corner in Turnham Green. Or would you prefer a pizza? Monster size, of course." Someone gave the monster a foot massage. Oh, that felt so nice. And at every kind act, kind word, kind deed, the demon grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less smelly, less offensive. And in what seemed like no time at all, the demon was back to the size when he first came in. But they never stopped. They kept on laying on the kindness until soon the demon was so small, the monster was tiny. The one more act of kindness and the monster vanished completely away. And the Buddha said, we call those monsters anger-eating demons. You give them anger, it makes them stronger and bigger and more aggressive. It's a beautiful simile because there are many anger-eating demons in your life. And that part of you which you don't like, which brings you down, is such an anger-eating demon. When you say, "Get out of my life," it will get worse and bigger and more trouble. So you use, you know, what many people think is reverse psychology, but it's Buddhist psychology. The things in your life you don't like, you say, "Welcome. Thank you for coming to be here with me. There's something you're teaching me, I'm not quite sure what, but welcome." And then you find that negative part of you will start to get smaller and smaller and smaller. You try to kick it out, it gets worse. You love it, it disappears. Do you understand? So that's a wonderful simile of the Buddha, which I apply to so many areas of life. You welcome problems. "Thank you for coming to visit me." The problem disappears. Gets smaller and smaller and smaller. Okay, the Buddha never mentioned about the subconscious mind, but the Freud was mentioning the subterranean forces. And it is true that sometimes the Buddha mentioned the underlying tendencies and the upadis. And sometimes you can say these are inclinations, these are possibilities, you know, of the mind. And those inclinations and possibilities, you know, we do create them, we do generate them. And because we create them and generate them, we can actually turn them around. Just in the light, the demon story. Not by getting angry at these negative parts of ourselves, but by accepting them and watch them vanish just because of kindness. So there are such subterranean forces, but you know, they are inclinations. Rather than being stored somewhere, they're just like karmic tendencies which we've developed over our lifetimes. But those karmic tendencies, we can always turn them to our advantage, whatever they are. The skill of humanity is whatever defect you have or disability you have, you can always make use of it. People who have no arms or legs make beautiful paintings with their mouth. And people who can't hear can feel. And so whatever so-called disability we have or problem, a good example is in Malaysia once, I was giving a series of talks there and somebody asked me, can you please counsel this girl because no one has ever been able to help her? And I said, of course I'll give her a try. And her problem was that she'd been violently raped and been to psychologists, doctors, therapists, and no one had been able to help her. When I heard that, I knew that the ordinary ways of dealing with this problem would not work. So what actually you do as a counselor, you put aside everything you've ever learnt, make your mind still and kind, and see what happens. So when she came in and told her story, which was horrendous, the violence of the rape was just makes you sick. But after she finished her story, the words which came out of my mouth, and I don't know where they came from, I said, you're so fortunate to have been raped. And it was like sort of circuits had been opened up which had been closed. As if a way of looking had been totally overthrown and a new possibility happened. It was a crazy thing to say. And some people think that how on earth can you say that, Ajahn Brahm? But it just came out. And then I sort of expanded on it, because once I heard me say these things, I knew what they meant. I said, you must be an incredibly powerful, strong woman. This has happened to you. And I'm sure that you'll be able to work through this. Transcend it, to get out of this terrible black place which your mind is in. And once you're out, you more than any other person, will be able to understand other people who have been violently raped. Understand it in a way which I will never know. And you'll be able to take their hand and say, I know. And mean it. Not just know what you feel like, but know the path out of that terrible prison. That's why you're fortunate. Because you'll be able to help so many women. When she heard that, it gave her a path, gave her meaning, gave her a solution. So that's how we use our wisdom to get people out of these terrible psychological problems. The inclination of the mind to help, to be kind, is there first of all. And I don't know how that's going to come out in speech or what you're going to say. Or how you're going to deal with the problem. But it actually works and it's very powerful. So does that make sense? Okay, and she did well. Just thinking, thinking outside the box. Doing things in different ways. So don't always do what you read in books. So be innovative. And you find you can solve problems which no one else can solve. Any other questions? Yeah.
I want to ask two questions.
You're going to be very smart in your next life asking two questions.
One is donating one's body for medical reserves.
Yes, yes.
With clarity.
Yes, sir.
And the other one is recurring engagement and play for, say, one issue.
Okay, yes. If it's donating your body to medicine, that's actually encouraged in Buddhism. And Buddhists are the most generous of organ donors. Because we know we're not going to make use of the body afterwards. And even though we know that the organs are harvested actually before we're really dead, we also know at that time, because if you're really totally dead, the organs are actually not viable to be transplanted to somebody else. So it's usually just Now just when the death process is irreversible and you're not going to feel any pain, and when you go to heaven, because you've given your liver, you're not going to suffer without a liver when you go to heaven. All those stupid ideas, if you give a liver, you probably have two livers in heaven or in your next life. The whole body's even better, because it's dana, it's giving, you don't need it anymore. So you give it to somebody who needs it much more than you do. So that's encouraged, it's good, it's wonderful. So please do that. And the second question about, you've got resentment over some issue and it keeps going on and on and on. Whoever did that to you, thank them. Thank you for giving me this beautiful lesson on how to deal with resentment. It's tough at the time. What they've done is given you a whole truckload of shit. And you didn't deserve it, did you? It's not your fault. It's stupid people who did that to you. But when you get a truckload of dung, you dig it into your garden. In that simile in my book, there's two things you do to a truckload of shit. One is a person puts it in their pockets, in their bags, up their shirt, and they carry it around with them. That's called resentment. And you'll find if you carry around shit, you lose a lot of friends. It's true. When you have lots of resentment and bitterness, people don't like being around you. But fortunately, there's something else you can do with the pain of life. Instead of feeling resentment, dig it into your garden and grow beautiful trees and flowers. The more shit, the better. And then what you find happens is you have this beautiful garden. And later on, that person who abused you, who cheated you, treated you so unfairly, you thank them. Without them, you wouldn't have a wonderful garden. I've noticed many of the great teachers, the people I've really admired in life, are the people who were abused and cheated, who were given such a hard life. But they managed to dig in that dung and create a beautiful garden out of it. So instead of like wasting all that shit on resentment, make a garden out of it. And then you thank that person. Thank you so much. There's another question over there somewhere. Yeah? What is the main difference between Theravada and Mahayana, especially the concept of bodhisattvas? If I look at it about differences, we can make lots of differences, but we can also make lots of similarities there. And one of the things which is similar is that the path of a bodhisattva, what you're supposed to do to become a bodhisattva, is develop the six paramis. Three of those paramis are sila, samadhi, and panya. So if you're going to be serious about being a bodhisattva, you've got to follow sila, samadhi, panya. Basically, you've got to follow the Eightfold Path. If you follow the Eightfold Path, you're going to be an arahat. So really, what is Theravada? It's not the theory, it's the practice. So the Buddha, just before he passed away, was asked this wonderful question and gave a brilliant answer. He was asked by Subhadra, is it possible in other religions to become enlightened? It's a great question, and the answer of the Buddha was brilliant. He said, in whatever religion, doesn't matter what name it is, in whatever religion you find the Eightfold Path, you'll find people becoming enlightened. So if Mahayana follows the Eightfold Path, you'll have enlightened beings. If Vajrayana, Christianity, Islam, whatever, if you follow the Eightfold Path, you'll become enlightened. It's what you do makes you enlightened, not the name you call your path. And anyway, what is Mahayana, Theravada, Vajrayana? Just a group of people who practice. So it's the people who practice makes you similar or different. Because in Theravada, there's people who practice all sorts of different ways. And the range of different practices and beliefs and ideas in Theravada is so huge that sometimes there's more difference within Theravada than between Theravada and Mahayana. So these days, we don't really worry about what school you belong to, what robes you wear. We're concerned about what you do. So if you're keeping precepts, you're meditating, you're becoming wise, I don't care whether you're Mahayana, Theravada, Vajrayana, whatever. Because that doesn't define you. What defines you is your practice. As the Buddha said, you're not a Brahmin because you were born in a Brahmin family. You're a Brahmin because you're a good person, keeping precepts, being peaceful, being compassionate. It's not your lineage which makes you a Buddhist. It's what you do. So these days, you try and have some syncretism, respect for everybody. So I've formed another yana. You know, you've got the Hinayana, Mahayana and Vajrayana. I decided to take the H from Hinayana, the Aha from Mahayana, and the Yana from Vajrayana. And what does that spell? Hahayana. So I'm a proponent of the Hahayana tradition. Making people laugh when they come to the temple. So, in theory, there's a difference. In practice, no. Does that answer your question, sir? Yeah. The best way of meditation, yeah. Usually when a person starts meditation, I teach them meditation on the breath. But if they can't do meditation on the breath, then I teach them Anapanasati. And if they can't do Anapanasati... You all know it's the same, isn't it? It's the same. Anapanasati. Yeah, but I don't tell people that. And if they can't do Anapanasati, then I give them Metta Bhavana. If they can't do Metta Bhavana, and I teach them loving-kindness meditation. And if they can't do loving-kindness meditation, I teach them letting-go meditation. They're all the same. They're all the same. They're all how to make your mind still and peaceful. All different ways of doing the same thing. Like Metta Bhavana, loving-kindness. You know the definition of loving-kindness I have in my book. The door of my heart is open, no matter who you are, no matter what you do. Total unconditional acceptance. Another word for that is called letting things be. The door of my heart is open to this moment. No matter what it is, what's happening, I don't reject this moment at all. I give unconditional acceptance. That's another word for letting things be. Without focusing on any person, if you're meditating, you're focusing on your mind. This thought, this tiredness, this restlessness, this pain in my body, whatever it is, the door of my heart is totally open to this. I don't reject anything. I'm at peace with whatever is happening in this one moment. You get very still and peaceful. The mind becomes very, very beautiful. If you do it properly and follow the instructions. However, many people never follow the instructions. Usually what happens when you get a new microwave, you plug it in first, and when it goes bang, then you read the instruction book. So get it clear exactly what you're doing, and then do it, and it works. It does work, but it's a hard thing to do. So that's why... You know, the mind needs a little bit of a trick, so if they can't do that letting go, then you do all these other ones, which is exactly the same. You do Anapanasati. What you're doing is you're just watching this breath and just letting this breath be. And being so kind to this breath. So this breath goes in and out. Just not trying to control it, just letting it flow, letting it be. So exactly the same what you're doing, we just give it different names, that's all. We give it different names because people get bored. The mind gets bored because it needs to be interested in things. Yes, because until we get to the point in meditation when it gets fun and joyful, then when it gets to that stage, I call it like the tipping point. Once it gets weird, you're sitting there and the breath is just so beautiful. You just don't want to do anything else. You just love staying with the breath. And it gets time for to go and you're just still sitting here. Or it gets time for the meal. You just rather sit in meditation, have something to eat. That shows you're getting some piti in your meditation. That's beautiful, that's natural, that's supposed to happen. After that time, there's no effort needed at all. You just can't stop yourself. You just go deeper and deeper and deeper. But to get to that point, we have all these little tricks and means. You know, doing little mantras. No, let go, let go, let go. Well, my favorite mantra, you know, in Thailand they have the mantra Buddho. You breathe in, you say Bud, breathe out, To, Buddho, Buddho. It's so common in Thailand. But that's because, like in Thailand, the word Buddho has got a very deep emotional resonance for people. It just does not work for Westerners. So in places like Australia or England, if it's a Caucasian, I give them another mantra. As you're breathing in, you recite the word shut. As you're breathing out, up. Shut up. Shut up. That works really well. Because after a while of saying shut up to yourself, you actually do shut up. And you're quiet. And when I make it funny like this, it gets interesting. People don't get bored. Oh, yes.
In Buddhism, is there such thing as ghosts or devils?
Ghosts. Yeah, certainly there are ghosts, and actually I was really disappointed yesterday, because one of my old friends from Cambridge, he was a guy called Dr. Tony Cornell. For about 25 years, he was the chief ghost hunter of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. He had this amazing business card, Dr. Tony Cornell, chief ghost hunter of the Psychic Research Society of London. And he had amazing stories about ghosts. And these are real ghosts. Do you want to hear a ghost story? Can we turn the lights down, please? And this is a good ghost story because it shows you your attitude towards a ghost and how people are just so stupid when a ghost appears. This was about 4 years ago. In Thailand, in the town of Gubi, which is in South Thailand, there was a Thai woman who was married to an English man. In the middle of the night, she had this vivid dream of a ghost. It was 3 days after the Boxing Day tsunami. And this girl appeared in her dream, vivid, a young English girl, blonde haired, young, but gashed all over her body with these awful wounds, with her hair a mess, bruised, her clothes torn to shreds. In the dream, she said, "Help me, help me. I was on Phi Phi Island when the tsunami hit. I'm dead. My mother in London is trying to call me, but my mobile phone is on the bottom of the sea. Right now," said this ghost, "the Thai soldiers are picking up my body in Phuket Island and putting it in one of the temples, which were temporary morgues. Help me. Can you do 2 things? I want a Buddhist funeral. Arrange one for me, but don't let my mother see me like this. Please give her a call and tell her to come after the cremation to collect my ashes. This is her telephone number," and recited a series of digits. This is a true story. We know this lady. And at the end of the digits, she woke up with full recall of the whole dream. She woke up her husband, told him about what she dreamed, and her husband was from London, I forget what part of London, and he recognized that as a valid London phone number. So she told her to ring, middle of the night in Thailand, late in the afternoon here in London. A woman answered that phone. After a short conversation, it turned out the woman who answered the phone here in London was desperately looking for her daughter who went to holiday on Phi Island. It was her. Names, description, was perfect. The mother knew intuitively she lost her daughter. Now she had what we call the closure. Knew she was dead. And because of the description and detail in this dream, the mother gave permission to have a Buddhist funeral. And the mother said, once it's arranged, let me know and I will come as my daughter wished to pick up her ashes. So the next morning, the English man and Thai wife drove to Phuket. Now they'd heard in the dream the name of the temple and the name of this girl. So they found that temple and it was chaos. They managed to get permission to go inside. And there they found this girl exactly as seen in the dream. The same torn clothes and gashes. It was this girl. So they got permission to have a quick funeral. Because at that time the soldiers, the government, were desperate actually to dispose of the bodies. And they rang the mother. The mother came from Heathrow, landed in Phuket. They embraced at the airport, cried, and handed over the ashes. And the mother took the ashes of her deceased daughter back to London. A few days later, the girl had another dream. In the middle of the night, this ghost appeared again. But this time, her hair was perfect, as if she'd been to Elizabeth Arden. Is that right? Because I've never been to a hairdresser in my life. Especially a woman's hairdresser. Is that where you go to get your hair done? Cosmetic. Who is it?
Tony and Guy.
Tony Guy, or whatever. Tony Guy's. But it's beautiful hair, and her clothes were these white, radiant clothes. And the lady said, or this ghost said, thank you so much. Look what you've done for me. I'm a deva. I can't ever thank you enough for doing this funeral service for me and for helping my mother. Out of gratitude, here for some more numbers. And she awoke a minute later with full recall, wrote down those numbers, but it wasn't a telephone number. Of course you know what it was. And it won too. And they made a small fortune. And that is a true story. The ghost told them the winning lottery number out of gratitude. And the moral of that story is this. If you see a ghost, don't run away yet. Awesome. Over here, you've got a number. If they don't give you one, then run away. And I should have mentioned actually, because you heard it in the London Buddhist Vihara, if you do see a ghost, you get a lottery number and it wins. 10% has to go to the ghost. Yes. How do we practice non-self? Is actually wherever there's a self, there's things which are owned by a self. So how you practice non-self is letting go of ownership. The first practice of letting go is being generous. You'll notice in this temple there are many boxes. They are not donation boxes, they are letting go boxes. So let go! That's the first thing. You don't own your money. It's given to you for a purpose. To enjoy, to invest for your family, but also to help with your temple, with the social work. So be kind to the temple in which you live. Number two, sort of your family don't belong to you. It's not your son or your daughter. These people come into your life. You don't know where from where, and you look after them, care for them. And then they leave, they may go to New York or Australia and get married. You have to let them go. They don't belong to you. You just look after them for a while Like a gardener nurtures a tree, so parents nurture their children and let them go. Your body doesn't belong to you. Doesn't matter how much you feed it, exercise it, look after it, it still gets sick. So your body is not yours. Now your mind. Your intelligence isn't yours either. I used to be so smart when I went to Cambridge University. I'm now 58 and I've forgotten everything. Well, not everything, but a lot. So even my intelligence I don't own. So let go. It's not yours. Let go of your mind. Your consciousness doesn't belong to you either. So let go of trying to control things. When you know it's not yours, you stop controlling it. You just flow with things. You let go. So that's how you practice non-self, by non-ownership. Any question in the back, yeah? Yes, the man just behind you, yeah? Yeah. Okay. Yep. Yeah. It's much easier to meditate when you're quiet in a peaceful place. So when there's background noise, it's a little bit more difficult. But if it's a constant noise, you don't really notice it anymore. But be a bit careful meditating on a tube, because if you get really deep, you'll miss your stop. You lost two jobs already. Don't matter, we can give you a job as a monk if you meditate well. Very good. It's still good fun to meditate. It's really worth it. If you lose a job, you know, it's much better to have a quiet mind than have a job. Yeah. Okay, what's the idea of a problem? Should we welcome problems? A great story in my book is, I think you're old enough, sir, to remember the British Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan. Remember Macmillan, the Prime Minister? Yeah, from Australia, okay, just like me. Okay, but anyway, this was in 1968, I think, when they had the Six-Day War between Israel and 66, between Israel against Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, I forget who else. You remember that one, yeah. Now, Harold Macmillan was a British Prime Minister. He just resigned at this time. Prime Minister was in 10 Downing Street. But nevertheless, he was regarded as an elder statesman, and so the media interviewed him. And they asked this question: what do you think, ex-Prime Minister, about the problem in the Middle East? Without any hesitation, the former Prime Minister said, there is no problem in the Middle East. And the interviewer was stunned. He said, don't you know there's a war going on right now? That tanks are firing at each other? Live rounds are ripping the life out of many soldiers? What do you mean there's no problem in the Middle East? And with calm precision, the ex-Prime Minister said, sir, a problem is something with a solution. There is no solution in the Middle East. Therefore, it cannot be a problem. Now, it's a simple statement, but that's really deep. And it's true. A problem is something with a solution. So if you've got incurable cancer, it's not a problem anymore. But if there's something you can do about it, then it is a problem. If there's something you can do, you should really give it everything you've got. But how much of our life do we waste time worrying about things which we can never really do anything about? And this is a problem. We should let those things be and focus on the places where we can be effective, we can make a change. So a problem is something with a solution. something you can do something about. When you can't do anything about it, leave it alone. It's not a problem anymore. But too often, we worry about things we can never do anything about. For example, the past. The past is not a problem. You can't do anything about it. Does that make sense? So great, like Faddy's saying, a problem is something with a solution. No solution in the Middle East. And he was right. Therefore, it can't be a problem. So he could put all of his energies on something which was more useful. So if your girlfriend is dumping you and you can't do anything about it, it's not a problem. That's true. Any other question anyone has? Going. I'm not going to be back for another couple of years. But you can't do anything about it, therefore it can't be a problem. Okay, thank you. Oh, I got one more question. Okay, last one, yeah. Why do bad things happen to good people? And good things happen to bad people? The answer is this, that when I was teaching meditation in prison, one day this man came up to me. He was one of the prisoners. He was an elderly man. And he said, "Can I have a private interview with you?" So I said, "Yeah, sure, after the meditation session we can spend a few minutes." And he came up to me and said, "Ajahn Brahm, I respect you so much, I would never lie to you. I'm not lying now. I just wanted to tell you, the crime for which I've been put in jail, I did not commit. I didn't do that. I'm innocent. And I'm honest with you, I didn't do that burglary." And as soon as he said that, the way he said it, I knew he was honest. And he was actually being honest. And I knew that in prison, is you got so little avenues to actually to amend injustices. You got unlimited phone calls, no money, you can't get to lawyers. But I could. And I thought, it's wrong to let an injustice, you know, go like that. And I started thinking of, you know, a few Buddhist lawyers I could ring up and get some money and ring up the newspapers and get this injustice righted. And as I was thinking what to do, he interrupted me. And smiling, he said, "But, Ajahn Brahm, there were so many other burglaries where I wasn't caught, I guess this is fair." So, why do good things happen to bad people and bad things happen to good people? You're not perfectly good. That's why sometimes bad things happen to you. If you didn't do it in this life, you probably did it in another life. So it's all coming around, it's all fair. So when you think that all life is unfair, it is fair. So stop complaining. You get everything you deserve. But also, don't underestimate other people. Because you may think, and because I'm a sort of, you know, you counsel, you talk to people, sometimes you look at people and you think, wow, they're so happy. That life is going so well for them. But then you look at them and find out what's going on inside. And they've got so much inner pain. You cannot really tell a person's well-being just by their, you know, their wealth, their health, or what appears to be their happiness. When you really get to know a person and they open up to you, you'll be surprised how people who are supposedly doing well in life are suffering immensely. Which is why that sometimes these people, you look, they're having a good life. They're doing well. And then you read that they've just committed suicide. Why? Everything's going so well for them. Why have they committed suicide? Because on the outside it looks good. But on the inside they have so much pain. And it's true. It's the inner pain, the thing which we can't see. is what causes people to kill themselves. And that inner pain is there with the so-called people doing bad things. On the outside it looks like things are going well for them, but on the inside they're being tortured. That's what happens. Does that answer the question? Because that's a great question. Yeah. I think the reason was when you rented out the house, you didn't do your research. Who are these people coming into my house? Yeah, because sometimes, you know, you think this is too good to be true, and it is too good to be true. So you've got to be very careful when you have property, when you do business. So to do business, you've got to really have almost a sixth sense. Otherwise you get cheated again and again and again. And people who start in business sometimes are very naive. And it's the naivety is their bad karma. They're not being wise enough. But you learn from that, and it's actually good for you, because now when you rent out your house, you're far more careful. Yeah. Okay, I think that's probably enough for now. So take care, be good, and see you next time. Do you wanna?
I want to thank you. Thank you for coming. Especially I want to thank Siranti da Silva, because Siranti Silva has invited Bhante to this country, this visit. When she was programming Bhante's talk, Siranti has given a priority for us to the London Buddhist Vihara. On behalf of our people, I would like to thank you, Siranti. And I don't know how to thank you, Bhante. Nearly 2.5 hours we have been able to purify our bloods, our minds. This is your village, Bhante. You have to be here. Once Buddha was sitting near to the Kapilavastu, Buddha was asked by King Ajatasattu, "Why are you sitting here, Bhante? The wind come through the my villages, my whole body make me so calm." So therefore, Bhante, we are really, really grateful to you sharing your fascinating, it's amazing memory, giving such enormous story, sharing your wisdom with us. Your journey, your life story itself is a fascinating for all of us. Everybody of us enjoyed very much during the hours and hours. I remember still, last time when you gave a beautiful story, that is duck and chicken. Still I remember. So many years we will remember again and again your talk. And so much, thank you so much. Also giving a good opportunity to ask question. Buddha also, just before his death, passing away, Buddha asked monks, "Do you have any doubts? Let me know." Similarly, following the Buddha's step, you ask, "Do you have any questions or problems?" Everybody was so happy and asked some questions. And thank you so much. And thank you so much for coming and giving this opportunity for us. you have very magnetic spiritual power. Wherever Bhante goes, hundreds of people, they love your stories. And thank you for coming again. I would like to ask, wish you a wonderful journey and wish you very good health, Bhante, through the power of the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha.